Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Actually, I believe it was big swinging dicks. So there was obviously an overexcited imagination on the part of some, I would suggest.
Because if he wants to know what misogyny looks like in modern Australia, he doesn't need a motion in the House of Representatives. He needs a mirror.
I love the mansplaining. I'm enjoying it.
What's mansplaining, Senator?
Welcome to In the House and In the Senate. I'm Alicia Aiken-Radburn and we're talking to women in Australian politics about who they are, what they do and why it matters. Sally McManus is the Secretary of the Australian Council of Trade Unions, the largest peak body representing workers in Australia. She is the first woman to hold the position of Secretary in the ACTU's 90-year history. Before joining the ACTU, McManus was the branch secretary and an organiser with the Australian Services Union. During her time in the union movement, she's led numerous campaigns to secure better outcomes for workers, notably the Equal Work, Equal Pay campaign for community services workers, a 7-year campaign that delivered pay increases of between 18 and 40% for all workers, the vast majority of which were women. So, Sally, primarily on this podcast, I've been talking to women involved in politics, parliamentarians, staffers, but I thought it was really important to speak to someone in the union movement because I think that that's where it's really the workplace where many Australians feel the practical effects of political decisions. And for me, it was a big part of how I became politically engaged. I was being paid $7.85 an hour back in the day at a bakery in the middle of Sydney CBD. And I thought to myself, this is low. Like I was 15, but I was like, this doesn't feel right. And I looked up the awards with a friend of mine and we discovered that we were being underpaid and we shifted into this like legal mode and we were writing these letters and we ended up being back paid. And I remember being like, people must join together to get better results. And then I realized that's a thing and that's called the union movement, and you are the leader of the union movement in Australia, the secretary of the ACTU. Can you tell me about the day in the life of the secretary of the ACTU, Sally?
Hey, yeah, absolutely. That's a great story, and I reckon that's the story of lots of people. Sometimes your first experience of unfairness is when you're young in the workplace and, you know, having your wages stolen is the first example of that. And all of those awards you went to go find were really fought for so hard by unions, by the Union Movement of Australia. My life, I've got to talk about it in terms of not COVID times, because COVID times are a bit weird. But before COVID, I'd probably spend half my time living out of hotel rooms and the other half at home, which is now in Melbourne. On days where I'm in hotel rooms, I'd wake up, listen to the morning radio. I'd read all the media stories around what's happening for workers. And then I'd go about visiting workers and unions in whatever city I'm in. So I like to do that a lot. So before COVID, I'd spend, like I said, about half the time. So all day, I'd be either in workplaces or in meetings with union leaders from all the different unions, representing everyone from, you know, nurses to Sparkies, discussing what their issues are and what was happening for them. And they're usually pretty full-on days. And then at the end of the day, sometimes I would, or during the day, sometimes I do some media as well. But at the end of the day, then I've got to catch up on all my emails, which are usually unrelenting. I try not to look at my phone. I might send out a few tweets. And then I'm a bit of a lone ranger when I'm on the road, and I'll probably just go and have a quiet dinner and go to bed and wake up and do the same thing the next day, probably get on a plane. When it's not COVID time, it's sort of like that, except I would like run for at least half an hour. I'll go to boxing at the end of the day too. I've been doing like some form of martial arts most of my life, and at the moment I'm about to turn 50. I'm doing boxing, so I get to get out some of the stress and visualize some of my enemies. But I do, when I'm in Melbourne, more meeting, making sure the ship of the ACTU is heading in the right direction, and just making sure our overall strategy is on track.
I really like that you mentioned that you make time for exercise, because this is the question that I've been kicking off every interview with. And I'm just like, when do you look after yourself? And I think that that is so good, and I might have to take up boxing.
I reckon it's really important to have a routine. And for me, it certainly is. And so it's either early in the morning or at the end of the day. And sometimes I can't, you know, do the boxing, I've got to cancel it because I've got to go elsewhere. I do it with a trainer. And that's good for me, because someone else gets to boss me around, because I sort of spend all day being in charge, and it's great to have, you know, a period of at least half an hour where someone else tells you what to do. But in terms of running, that's sort of an easier one that you can build in time to do that. And so, you know, keeping that routine of exercise, I reckon, is really important for health and for your mental health.
I think that that is... I'm trying to do that with my 5 a.m. F45 at the moment, which I've just kicked off again, and it's not. Well, I'll report back. Sally, you at the age of 16, you first started getting involved in union activity. You joined other students in supporting a teacher's strike, a protest against teacher layoffs by the Greiner government. Tell me about that process of being activated as a unionist. It's a different path to go down, particularly at 16, before you'd even reached university, where I think a lot of young people do become activated by the union movement, and their path starts there.
I can't say that, looking back, that I would have seen it as even like being activated as a unionist or even a union event. It was probably later on where I was able to understand the full picture of it. But essentially what I knew is our teachers had been sacked at school. Our teachers were organising a big protest, and some of us, not all of us, got on trains from suburban Sydney and took the long trip into town to go to what was, you know, back then one of the most amazing experiences, to be surrounded by over 50,000, you know, people who were all saying the same thing. And for me, it wasn't the idea of even the injustice of our teachers being sacked, which was pretty bad in the middle of the HSC, but it was actually the feeling of power that I experienced from being around a big group of people who all felt the same, and that it's hard to explain that particular feeling, and you can't really replicate it. I don't think you can replicate it very easily on social media, although you can to a degree, but that feeling of, I guess it was solidarity of people going away together in a direction and all feeling the same, and that feeling that you get of power, which is way beyond yourself. So I think that's probably the essence of unionism. It certainly is. But I felt it at that time. So that was definitely, like, I didn't forget that feeling and the sense that that's where change happens.
How did that track for you? What took you from that 16-year-old heading in on the train to you were the president of the Macquarie University Students' Union? How did that journey carry through and take you to being the secretary of the Australian trade union movement?
To be honest, some days I can't believe it myself. Like, I come from a very ordinary background, neither of my working class background in suburban Sydney, and neither of my parents were big union activists. It's not as if, like, my dad was in the union, but it's not really anything that was talked about. Public school and got into university, first in the family to be at university, studied philosophy of all things. I decided to run for student union, not really expecting to win, and I did. And so I think I was like 20 when that happened. So that was like an early learning experience, and we were having a big fight with the university around probably the same thing students are fighting for around now. It's around funding and around how much vice chancellor was being paid and how little was being put into students, and around the things that governments were doing. But then the ACTU, which obviously I'm the head of now, advertised for trainee organisers. So organisers are people whose job it is to organise workers, to bring about power, that feeling that I had when I was 16, effectively. So I was just so excited when I heard them advertise that, and I thought, wow, like, being like having a job where it's your whole job to do that, I can't think of anything more that I would love to do more. And so I was lucky enough to get that job as a trainee organizer, and I was 21 or 22 then, and 22 I think, and so started off pretty young in the trade union movement. That was back in 1994, and I was an organizer for my union. So it took a long time to learn that job. It's not an easy job, and sort of the craft of learning how to build power in a workplace and how to then achieve things does take a while. I did that job for, which I absolutely loved, for about 11 years, and then I stood to be the leader of my union, and which I won that. So I was the leader of my union when I was about 32 or 33. And I stayed in that position, which I also loved, until for another 10 years. And then I thought, well, either I stay in this, or there's all these young people coming underneath me that are really, really talented. Maybe I should have a go at the big job. And so I made a big sort of risk. I left what I was doing, moved cities. And I took up a position at the ACTU as a campaigner, as a sort of the campaign director. And it happened to be that the secretary at the time, like about a year and a bit into that job, he suddenly left. And so I put up my hand and said that I would like the position. And I was lucky enough to get the support of all the unions. So some of it was, when you think back, like just random luck. Like, I was trying all the time to do things, like to get the traineeship, and obviously to stand for positions, and you've got to sometimes take risks as well. But also, I guess I did want to be the ACTU secretary, and sort of, you know, set about putting myself in a position that that if, you know, the union thought I was good enough, that they'd be able to pick me.
I want to get to the ACTU and the current priorities of the ACTU, but first I just want to ask you, I really liked how you talked about the need to hone your craft as an organiser, because I feel like that is very transferable across a lot of workplaces and for young women. I always hear this phrase used, imposter syndrome, and I know, like, you know, even myself, I sometimes walk into work and I'm just like, oh God, I don't know what I'm doing. And I'm really interested to know, I feel like the union movement would be a challenging environment. I know I've got, well, my best girlfriend works at the AMWU, and I've always been so impressed when I hear her on the phone to, like, delegates that are, you know, 55, 60-year-old men. And I wonder, as you were quite young starting off in the union movement as a woman, how did you negotiate gender and power dynamics and asserting yourself?
Oh, yeah. So that wasn't straightforward. How did I navigate it? I did my best, basically, but it wasn't that easy. So, of course, being a young person, you have that problem in the first place. People aren't going to automatically trust you, or for that matter, give you credit that you might know what you're doing, because in a way you probably didn't when you were that young. But you know, you still needed the confidence to go out and do the job every day, and also being a woman. So it was like obviously a double issue. I've sort of always just taken, not always, wrong to say always, but I've learnt to just basically be yourself in whatever circumstance you're in, not try and, you know, never lie to people, just tell them the truth. If you don't know something, be honest about it. Really apply myself to, you know, the thing that I believe in, like the thing that I believe in, and the principles that you have, like stick to them. I find if you're honest with people and they can see, you know, that you may not, be the most experienced person in terms of your age, or they might have their own sort of internal sexism or external or just overt sexism. But in the end, I think they will respect you if you're honest, and if they absolutely know you're going to be on their side. The union world, every single day, it's about conflict. I'm not someone, and I don't think all union officials are people that, you know, really love it. Like, don't do it because you love conflict, but you get used to it. And you've got to be tough, like you do. And so just in order to be tough, it's not like an outside performative thing. I think it's more about just knowing where you stand. So being really strong in your principles and your beliefs, and also knowing that you've got a whole group of people behind you or with you at any time. That's where you draw strength from, and that's the reason why, you know, you don't back down in situations. So, I mean, that's a whole lot of things you learn over time, but it's not as if, like anyone, you come to a new job or a new position like knowing nothing. I look back in a way, I thought, oh, thank God that I didn't, know all the things I didn't know, because I probably would have been too scared to get up every day. But you know, I just believed in what I was doing, and I felt I was so lucky to have that job.
Taking you to the Australian Council of Trade Unions at the moment, what's keeping you up at night at the moment? What's on the top of the to-do list for you?
Inequality, and the fact that our country's getting worse and worse. And by inequality, I'm talking about economic inequality. So effectively what's happening in Australia is younger generation inheriting worse living standards, and that hasn't happened. That's happening, and it's because basically the people at the top, the very rich, are just getting richer and richer, and the people, it's not even at the bottom, everyone else is not. So it's all about fairness and about fairly sharing, you know, the wealth that we have as a country. And so we know that that's a problem, and that's the thing that the main driver of what we're all about, like trying to address. And I guess unions have always been about that. It's about fairly sharing the fruits of your labour, quite literally. And then below that, there's all the reasons why, and there's lots of reasons. And essentially part of, you know, what I do is try and address those reasons.
What are the levers that you think we need to start pulling in order to address that intergenerational fairness? You know, like, I'm 28 and it's something that I worry about, and, you know, I feel like I'm getting on, so I can't even imagine. You see it with like the school strike for climate action, and that's just talking about the climate. What practical steps does the government need to be taking to put us in a better place in the future?
Well, there was time in history in Australia where we're a much more equal. In fact, for a period of time, we were one of the most equal countries in the world. And outcomes, and by that I mean basically your quality of life as a society and for everyone, improves because of that. And it really comes down to what type of bargaining power do working people have compared to how much bargaining power employers, and in this case in our country, basically the employers who really dictate what goes on are the big employers, not your local shops or not your local cafes. It's your multinationals and big business in our country that really determine things. And what's happened over a period of time is that that bargaining power has shifted, and it's shifted because governments have allowed workers' rights to be taken off them, and that's meant that work's become more insecure. We've got this casualisation and gig economy have really spread, and wages have been kept low. Where you give workers the support and the rights they need to be able to balance that bargaining power, well, it's sort of up to them. They can organise and negotiate for better wages and conditions. They can push for that right across industries. But at the moment, it's just so out of balance. And so that's the fundamental thing that's got to change.
I want to delve a little bit deeper into the gig economy. I think that this year we've seen some really, really awful stuff. We've seen deaths within the industry. And I think it's also been really, frankly, just upsetting to see where incidents like that sit within newsworthiness. I don't think that we've heard enough of them. And I don't think that we're seeing the reaction from the companies that employ gig workers that we would in any other circumstance where something is receiving huge news coverage. So I was just wondering where is that you would work with gig workers quite often. Where's that up to, and is there any sort of comfort, or are we working towards change there, practical change from those employers?
I think we absolutely are, and the big problem is those employers are pretending they're not employers. So the Ubers and the Deliveroos say basically, oh, no, we're just this, you know, app company, and everyone else, all the people that, you know, are riding and delivering food, they're all their own businesses. And so they're basically just using a legal argument to get out of, you know, giving workers their rights. Where it's entirely, you know, clear that they are just modern day employers, and they're just using technology in a way that they can, because technology allows them to. So, and of course they're reaping in all the profits. You think about those, you know, delivery apps, and especially with the pandemic, just how much their businesses have grown. And part of that's been on the back of exploiting workers. And unfortunately in Australia, like, there's been, you know, six riders die in the last part of last year. And that's because effectively they've got less rights than workers did in our country 100 years ago. And that's because they don't get all the basic things like the minimum wage, like health and safety laws. All of those basic things everyone else gets that protects them and makes sure they're not exploited. And they don't get them because of this sort of legal fiction that the companies are trying to uphold. Now, the hope with all of this is that it's not just Australia where this is happening. It's happening all around the world. And workers and some governments around the world are taking action because they just can see that this is ridiculous and unfair that they're doing this. And so there's been court cases, there's been law that's been brought in. In Australia, there's been court cases taken by the Transport Workers Union. Some they've won, some they've lost. The problem is these companies have so much money, as soon as you win a case, they just change something slightly so that they can get away with saying they're not an employer again. So really there's got to be change by governments. Like, governments have got to step in and say that within this particular area, these people are workers, therefore they deserve the same rights. And they can do that by a simple change to the law. But, of course, our current government's not too keen or in giving workers any extra rights. And I'll just say to those people who, I mean, you and I, you know, feel it when you know, people are killed and people are exploited, but some people will either ignore it or just say, oh, that's not good, but it doesn't affect me. Any job that can be broken down to a gig or a task can be allocated by an app. And if we don't update our laws to make sure all workers, no matter who they are, get rights, it could be teachers, nurses, like anyone's job could be allocated in that way So, you know, if we don't take rights to protect work, the delivery riders, it will be a matter of time before this gets into other areas, which it already is in the NDIS. That's how a lot of those workers are now defined too.
How close are we, do you think? Because this seems like, you know, as soon as we have this conversation, I feel like a lot of people listening they feel that sense of urgency. Like, this is basic. This needs to change. We're in 2021. We need laws that reflect how we work. How close do you think we are to see some tangible change?
Unfortunately, it's really, really hard to win laws that get introduced into Parliament and then cover every worker. And the reason why is there's massive vested interests in stopping that happening. And so, for example, just look at the issue of wage theft. Like, that's just law breaking. Now, if that was happening in any other area, like if there's this massive outbreak of, I don't know, people breaking into houses, you can imagine government saying, oh, we're going to act on this, we're going to do this, we're going to do that. But they don't when employers are stealing workers' money. And that's because of this vested interest problem. So whenever working people have tried to push for change, they always face like a big opposition. And then when you've got a government that mainly listens to those vested interests, which of course a coalition government does, it's a very big uphill battle. So the elements that you need are very clear about what needs to happen for the change, which we are. We've done all of that work. We know what's got to happen with the law. And we've got to, you know, win public opinion and like those unions have been doing and like we're doing and arguing for. But even that's not enough. Then you need to, you know, have a government that's willing to do it. So it's been the same, like whether it be like the fight for you know, 48-hour working week or equal pay for women, all of these things were never given to us. So it was just like a really hard fight. And I imagine this, unfortunately, will be the same.
I want to take you to minimum wage. I think that, you know, COVID has shown us, and it's unfortunate that it took COVID to see JobKeeper elevated to a rate that actually pulls people out of poverty rather than continues the cycle of poverty. I wanted to ask you about both JobKeeper and the minimum wage. The ACTU wants to see the minimum wage rise. Can you tell me about what the practical impact of that would be for a worker?
Yeah, so one of the things that Australia led the world in is this idea of a living wage. And back in the early part of last century, so a long time ago now, 25 years ago, we won this idea that if you work full time, you should earn enough so that you can support yourself and you can support a small family. And that was a principle in law won by Australian workers. Then you look at some of the fights in the United States now, they're all living wage fights. That's what they talk about. $15 an hour is all a living wage fight, and they call it that. Around the world, they call it that. Well, we won it first. Then what happened is, like I was saying before, over the years, governments have stripped workers of their rights. And now our minimum wage is not a living wage. It's less than what poverty levels are, less than what a living wage should be. And what should it be? So around the world, there's been this discussion, and they say it's about 60% of the medium or the average wage. So that means that our wage would need to go up by about $5 an hour. The minimum wage, so it's around 20 at the moment, so it would need to go up. That would mean that if you're working full time, you're not in poverty. And so that's a fight, that's a justice fight. You know, the very idea that you should work full time and not be able to support yourself is not just un-Australian, it's something that we should just reject as a society, no matter what country you're in. So there's that issue. And once again, like I was saying, that up against us are all the employers, all the vested interests and the government. Every single year we argue for increases and every single year they argue against it. And so what we've been saying is that actually the government needs to change the laws to mandate that that the minimum wage should be at least a living wage so that we get that principle back again.
And I think the reason why these fights are so important is because if you strip it all back, we're really just talking about how we want to live, how we want people to be able to live as a society, quality of life, life short. And I think that that's why fundamentally, I think sometimes we can become distracted by politics, by headlines, by, you know, who's appearing on Insiders this weekend. But at its core, it's all just about how we want people to be able to live and live, not just survive.
That's so true. It's so true. I mean, what is life? And like you say, it's so short. It's about, in the end, how happy you are. And so, of course, being able to have a decent place to live, being able to, if you want, have a family, being able to eat healthily, all of those things, have a little bit extra so that you can do other fun things is the whole, you know, what is a good life? And so, you know, there's plenty of wealth in the world for every single person to have that good life, except we don't, because the really rich people are hoarding it and they don't want to give it to others. And so, unfortunately, like I was saying before, it's always a struggle to win fairness and to get what is a fair share of the world's wealth. And so in Australia, the uni movement's always played that role, and obviously we continue to do it.
I feel like you have quite a rewarding job.
Yeah, well, at least you know that you're achieving something every day and you're fighting the good fight, absolutely. So, and it's also really never boring. That's absolutely for sure. Can be stressful, but the stress is well worth the reward of knowing that you've got the privilege of being part of an amazing movement.
Sally, I've just got two more questions to end on. I wanted to take you to Parliament House and parliamentary culture. I'm a former staffer, and it's been pretty harrowing as a staffer to see the stories. You almost like I had to turn 7:30 off because there was just one too many story. I was wondering your perspective as a union leader. What have you thought of the action taken by the Morrison government so far to protect workers in Parliament House? And what are the next steps to addressing the environment for women in Parliament House?
Well, I think Parliament House is the ultimate show of how power and privilege lead to these types of things, an unchecked power and privilege. There's no workplace more like that than Parliament House. And you know from working there, and I certainly know from having to spend time there, that it's full of people who just have entitlement, like they honestly do. And because they are the most powerful people in the country, they sometimes that absolutely, you know, supercharges that. So change at Parliament House is absolutely important, but we've got to remember that sexual harassment and sexual abuse go way beyond Parliament House. Like, it's in workplaces across the country, and where you see power and entitlement or privilege like operating, you're gonna see it. So that's why the changes that need to happen aren't just ones at Parliament House. So, for example, sexual harassment, making those laws stronger, not leaving it up to workers to try and fight for strong laws or strong policies, even workplace by workplace. We as a country should say that we're going to have strong laws that mean that a worker, if they're experiencing sexual harassment and their employer is not doing anything about it, they've got somewhere to go, an independent umpire to go, and that person would have the power to do things, for example, like say, I'm sorry, I'm going to ensure that the person who the allegation's made against is moved to another department. If the employer's not doing it, this person does it. Like, all the things that clearly need to happen to protect people when they are the victims of that power and privilege. So I think what needs to happen is better laws for all workers, women and men, so that, you know, we found, you know, things like, for example, racial discrimination, sexual discrimination, and then sexual harassment, big changes don't really happen until it becomes unlawful. And so then it's in the interest of the employer to make sure it doesn't happen either. So if employers think that they need to make the change because otherwise there'll be consequences for them, they'll do it. If they think that they don't necessarily need to because there'll be no consequences, a whole lot of them won't. So we can't just rely on goodwill all the time. We need strong laws.
A major reason why I was motivated, I guess, to start this podcast was because I was feeling so negative about the coverage that we'd seen this year. And I wanted to amplify the voices of women in politics and politics adjacent, just to remind particularly young women that there are some amazing people in positions of power and influence who are doing great things. So my last question was, I've been feeling very inspired by our chat. I'm just like, tomorrow at work, I'm feeling good. The imposter syndrome's gone. I was wondering, what's your biggest piece of advice to young women and young people in general who are interested in unionism, the union movement, and want to get involved?
Well, just do it, I would say, absolutely. You can start small in your own workplace, and it's really all unions are is about people deciding that they're going to stick together and, you know, in the face of, you know, trying to, you know, the powerful, okay, we're all going to stick together and stick to our guns, and that's where our power is going to come from. But I wanted to address a little bit of different advice for young people, especially young women around imposter syndrome that you talked about. So I've got this little trick that I'm really happy to share. You know how sometimes, like, for, you're sitting in a meeting or you're at some event and you think, oh, I won't say anything because really, you know, I'm worried that it's not going to come across correctly, or I'm not, what I've got to say is not important, or you're just nervous, or you're thinking that I shouldn't really be here, I'm not up to it, all those things that you said. Just think about, find a bloke that's around your age, around your level, no matter what your level is, someone that you know is not as smart and capable as you, and watch how that person behaves. Do they for one minute think that I shouldn't speak because what I've got to say isn't important, or I shouldn't take up time in this meeting? Not once would that thought even cross their mind. And just remember, well, if they can do it, well, you certainly can. So sometimes it's worthwhile carrying around the very ordinary bloke in your back pocket and just reminding yourself of him at any point that you think that your voice isn't worth being heard.
Live life with the confidence of an ordinary bloke, which is a lot of confidence.
A lot of confidence.
Thank you so much for speaking to me, Sally. I really appreciate it. And I'm going to be putting some links to the Young Workers Centre on my Instagram so everyone can check it out. And they can follow you as well. You're mostly on Twitter.
I am on Instagram too, but they might have to put up some of my
bird photos.
But there's stuff too.
Thanks so much, Sally. I really appreciate it.
Thank you. That was heaps of fun.
Oh, good. I'm so glad. See you later.
Bye.
In the House and in the Senate is recorded on the land of the Whadjuk people. This land was never ceded. It always was and always will be Aboriginal land. If you enjoyed this episode of In the House and In the Senate, please jump into your podcast app, subscribe, and give me a quick rating and review. This will help the podcast reach more people, and I will personally be incredibly grateful. Also, be sure to head over to the podcast Instagram at In the House In the Senate, where I'll be sharing content from our guests, throwbacks to my time in staffing, and resources to help you get more involved in the political system. You can also follow my personal account at alicia.aikenradburn. Thanks for listening, and speak to you next week.
Bye-bye. Goodbye. Bye.
Next question. See ya.